Hello and welcome to episode 98 of The Thing About Golf, Golf Australia Magazine's ongoing search for answers to the question, why do people get so hooked on this game? Rod Murray's my name, and on this episode, we're talking elite golf, but not in the way most of us would assume. In recent years, the growth in both the promotion and visibility of all abilities golf has grown almost exponentially, and those efforts culminated earlier this year in the inaugural staging of the G4D Open at Woburn in England. For those not aware, G4D stands for Golf for the Disabled, and of all the formats of the game, it is this inclusive, all abilities one that is perhaps the most important. At the time of recording, Ireland's Brendan Lawler was the world's number two ranked G4D player, and he was fresh off winning that inaugural Open. A professional himself, Lawler has been a visible and active campaigner for G4D and is a regular visitor to Australia, where Golf Australia's head of programs and inclusion, Christian Hamilton, has been one of the driving forces behind international growth in this area. Brendan's a fabulous advocate, not only for G4D, but for golf as a game. And I hope that you enjoy this chat with him as much as I did. The first thing we have to say, Brendan, which we say to all of our guests at the start, this is a commitment, so we thank you for taking the time. The clue's in the title, The Thing About Golf. We're going to come to your story as we go, but what's the thing about golf for Brendan Lawler? It's a nasty question, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a hard one to start off with. For me, it's definitely the obsession with trying to get better. Mm-hmm. That's what I love about it. And whether you're off 18, 28 or scratch, or even if you're Tiger Woods, there's always room for improvement. And I think that's the wonderful game. You can go out tomorrow and shoot 3 under, go out the next day, shoot 3 over, and you can always work on what's going good and what's going bad. So I think that's the beautiful thing about it.
Yeah. Some of us never get 3 over or 3 under. Brendan, you're in some fairly elite company with that. Have you been through all those 20, 28, 18 scratch? You've done the whole journey, I would imagine, like most. It's one of the great things about the game. Everybody starts off hopeless.
100%. I'll tell you a funny story, actually. I started off in a golf club called RD Golf Club when I was quite late getting into the game. I was 16 and I handed in my 3 cards. You do that in Ireland to get your handicap, and I got a handicap of 28. And I was a national pitch and putt champion at the time. I was quite good short game. So I went out my first event and I had 52 points. So I thought I was going to get kicked out of the golf club after that. I didn't think it was any good. It was my first time. So the guy's like, you need to relax yourself. So he cut me 8 shots on the spot, straight down to 20. And then it was just... As I said, the obsession with trying to get better.
Yeah. It's a funny thing about the game, isn't it? That's not that 52 points is uncommon, but it's not uncommon for beginners after a couple of rounds to have an amazing round, 45 plus points. That gets harder and harder the further you go, doesn't it? It gets you hooked on the gateway drug of fast improvement, but to get from 28 to 20, pretty quick journey, to get from 5 to 2, much, much longer.
That's what I found out. In my first 2 years, I got down to 5. And then from 5 to scratch, I turned professional off +2. So I think I got down to 5 when I was around 18. But the transition from 5 to +2 took about 3 years.
Yeah,
it was like minimal. Mm. It's like you could make no mistakes. You suddenly had feck all shots. So it literally went from, right, I had a wee bit of a buffer here. If I make bogey, I'm okay. To literally not making any mistakes. And I think that's the hard thing about it.
Yeah. In fact, standing in the shower on comp day in the morning, having your shower, you're already 2 over when you get to
exactly.
+2.
Yeah. Haven't even got to the course yet.
Yeah. Greg Norman once said, I've said this a couple of times on the podcast, maybe I might get bored with it, but I'd love to get your input on this. He once said that the difference between the 20 marker and the scratch marker is not as big as the difference between the scratch marker and the touring pro. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does make sense. From being on the circuit the last few years, playing with the tour players, there's zero wastage. Mm. Like they think everything out. I think the difference with a 20 handicapper, if they have 200 yards over the water and it's a 3 wood that can only go 200, they'll take on the shot.
Yeah.
Where the tour pros will lay up and try and get up and down with a wedge. So I think it's the mind frame of how people think is the difference in the scoring. And as well, the tour pros are putting is ridiculous. they don't miss much on the greens from inside 10 feet, and I think that's the major key as well.
Yeah. Do we as recreational golfers understand how good tour players are, even the ones that we might not have heard of? It always staggers me when I see a guy who's come from America to perhaps to play the Australian Open, not very well known. You go out and follow him, it's like, how's this guy not the best player in the world? He never makes a mistake. They're all like that.
Yeah. And that's what, like, I've played Challenge Tour, I've played DP World Tour, I've been in America, we've done PGA. And by playing with such amazing players, it's what I can notice is the mentality.
Mm.
It's their temperament. It's their reactions when things aren't going well. And if you put 100 players, 100 of the best players in the world, talent-wise, there's not much between them.
Mm.
But mentality-wise, there could be a 15 shots a tournament. Not a tournament, for like the week. So I think it's definitely in the mind when you get to a certain level.
Yeah. Let's talk about you, Brendan. You are, I want to start at this end of your career. You're the inaugural G4D Open was held in May at Woburn. This is G4D is golf for disability. What's the stand for there, the acronym?
Yeah, golfers for disability.
Golfers for disability. So you wanted the inaugural Open, the first one they'd had put on by the RNA at Woburn. So they can never take that off you. You're going to be that forever. Even after we're both long gone, you'll still be the one who won the first one. Tell us, with golfers for disability, what's your disability, if you call it that? And I know not everybody does.
Yeah, so I was born with a condition called Ellis-Van-Creveld syndrome, which is a shorter limbs and shorter stature. So I was also born with a hole in my heart, so I had to get VSD repair at 6 weeks old, which was unheard of because the operation was so intense that for someone that young, they shouldn't survive something so intrusive. So I got that done at 6 weeks. And there was a lot of, I lived in the hospital for the first year of my life. And when I got that done, I didn't get out till I think I was 13 months old when I got out of the hospital.
Wow.
So tough for mom and dad being in hospital for so long. And it wasn't like I was just sick. I was really in a coma. It was nearly death stuff. So to be honest, the Ellis-Van-Creveld wasn't the big issue when I was born. It was the hole in my heart with all the complications. And to be honest, the disability kind of kicked in when I was 7 or 8. Then I had knocked knees, so the operation started to come. It affects your teeth. I was born with an extra digit on my fingers. So all this stuff started to come when I was young. But to be honest, I think sport was a fantastic leveler. We played Gaelic football. I don't know if you heard of it in Ireland, but it's pretty physical.
Organised violence. Like organised violence, I think they call it, don't they?
Exactly. Yeah. It's probably a step down from Aussie rules. Yeah. It depends what team you're playing. But I was big into the Gaelic football and hurling. I love sport. And I felt if I could compete in sport against people that are 2 foot taller than me, I didn't feel any different. And that's when the golf sort of kicked in. As I said, I started pretty late, but pitch and putt, I was winning tournaments when I was 11 and 12 against adults. And when you're doing that, you really don't feel different. So I took that approach to life where sport was a fantastic thing. And when I was on a sports field, I felt normal. So in everyday life, I took the same attitude and felt normal as well.
How tall are you, Brendan?
4'11". I give myself 5 foot. I put that on the resume. I have to give myself 5 foot. Yeah.
Pick it up. We'll give you that one. That's fair enough.
All right.
Yeah, indeed. I would imagine that hurling and Gaelic football at some point are no longer an option because of your physical condition. I mean, I can't imagine. You only got to look at AFL. The small guys are 6'1". they're short guys running around on the field.
100%. I think I quit Gaelic when I was 16. So to be honest, when I started noticing the difference was probably 12 between my peers. So growing up, yeah, I was a wee bit smaller, but when everyone was taking that big growth spurt, I wasn't. So I was a tricky player. I was a corner forward, used to score points, but the physicality wasn't there.
Yeah.
So yes, I could score points and I could do players, but when I got hit a shoulder, when I had bad asthma as well, so long games didn't suit me. I was very tired, and mom and dad weren't keen on me playing either.
No,
dad was involved in Gaelic football. My brother played, and he loved to see me there till a certain age. But he was like, safety comes first. So we found golf and took it from there.
I was going to say, you used up all your hospital time when you were first born, mate. You don't get to have the teenage trips to hospital. That's fair enough too.
tell you, there was plenty of them too. Yeah. I was reckless.
How did you find golf then?
It was, well, I played pitch and putt from a very young age. My granddad loves the game, loves golf, would have followed Greg Norman, Arnold Palmer, all the greats of the game. And he always had ambitions for one grandson or one granddaughter to take it up. And it was me. He had a golf club in my hand when I was 4 years old. And we played pitch and putt for hours on end. He used to take me during the summers and we play maybe 2-3 rounds a day. And it was fun for me. So I was actually practicing, but I was getting better because I enjoyed it. And then I took to golf at 16. I didn't really fill out. My chest started to get bigger. My legs were getting bigger. And the power started to come at 16. And I joined golf and just fell in love with it. Had 52 points the first round. Mm-hmm. And I just said to myself, you have a talent for this. But it wasn't an ambition to turn professional. It was just an ambition to go out on a Friday and a Saturday and play golf and enjoy it.
If all our golf talk has you itching for a round, check out the Golf Now app. Easily book social golf online at hundreds of courses across Australia, including some of Golf Australia's top 100 tracks. Download the free app or visit golfnow.com.au today. I think lots of people understand that getting hooked on it sort of notion. You wouldn't have realised it at the time, Brendan, but my goodness, what a favour your granddad did you with all that pitch and putt at this end of your golf career. That must really have paid dividends, I'd imagine.
Yeah, 100%. And it really paid dividends in the start because I wasn't long. I wasn't getting it out there off the tee. Courses were long. So I sit and say driver 3 wood to the edge of greens. And I had to rely on the short game to get up and down. Yeah. So it really stunned me early on. And when I gave up pitch and putt, to be honest, my short game really suffered. So even the first year or two into my professional career, I could really feel that I wasn't getting up and down from 60 yards where it was a certainty before. So where I thought my strengths were still going to stick with me, it just goes to show you always need to work on these things to keep them sharp. Yeah. So it did go, and then I practiced up in Carton House as well. So they have a fantastic short game facility. So 2-3 days a week I had to spend there trying to dial it all back in. And you do that weekly now. It's great.
That's what you do. You're a pro now. We'll come to that in a minute. Real lesson for all recreational players or all golfers who are trying to improve. It's a real mistake a lot of us make, isn't it, that you only got to go to a driving range to see blokes standing there smashing drivers all over the place. They're not actually getting any better with the driver. They're just hitting a lot of them. And while they're doing that, they're ignoring something they might be good at, like putting or perhaps chipping or their wedge game. And when you don't practice them, they become a weakness as well, don't they? Your golf goes backwards.
100%. And if I was giving anyone advice, it'd be 70-30 for short game. 70% short game, 30% range. Yeah. Because you don't gain your shots off the tee. You gain your shots on the greens, especially when you're on the higher handicapper. It's the putting and chipping that suffers. And I think it's important to get that dialed in.
It's all we talk about, though, isn't it? In media, how long Rory hits it, how long Dustin Johnson is, how long John Rahm is. There comes a time when that becomes more important, I guess, if you're good at all that. But there's no point being the longest player in golf if you haven't got a short game, is there? There's lots of long drive guys who could never compete with Rory or probably even you.
Yeah, it's mad. But like, even if you look at Rory's round this week, I don't know if you watched the Genesis Open, but
how could you not? Rory in full flight. That's as good as golf gets, isn't it?
Exactly. But he was probably 60 or 70 in the putting stats. Like, his putting wasn't fantastic and he still won the tournament. So imagine if he can get that putting thing going.
Yeah.
It just shows how important it is.
Yeah, absolutely. How many players in that field do you reckon could have hit that 2-iron into the last?
Oh,
some shot, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's just under the circumstances. It was playing the hardest hole of the day. Like, you're hitting 2-iron into a 208 where he probably usually hit 7-iron. That's how strong the wind was. To pull that off and to hold the putt was just, it was just major-esque. It just shows why he's one of the best in the world to do that.
The discipline to pull the 2-iron when it's normally a 7-iron apart from anything else, for most of us, that's just such a huge, you wouldn't have, can't possibly be a 2-iron. Normally it's a 7-iron this fight. So just have the discipline to pull the club is the first part of the equation, isn't it? And then to hit the shot that he did, obviously.
Big time.
Yeah.
Like, the caddy had a big influence in that decision as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll bet he'll get his cut, no doubt. They've proved a pretty good team. Well, I'm going to give away a secret. You would know Rory pretty well, I'd imagine. I'll give away a secret. We're recording this the week of the Open. This is Tuesday night in Australia, Tuesday morning in the UK. Can he get it done? Can he get it done after winning the Scottish, Rory? It's a big ask, isn't it?
My heart says yes.
Yeah.
But going back to back is very difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is all I'll say. But yeah. I wouldn't put it past him if he went out and won it.
No. Rory's great. When you watch Rory, you can tell when he's playing well. He starts to bounce. And if he bounces, just give him the trophy because he's.
Exactly. When he's that sort of perk in his step where he glides to the tee box. He doesn't walk.
No. Yeah, exactly. Have you got to know Rory? I imagine you must have been quite a few of the tour players, I would assume. And what's that experience been like for, I imagine you were a golf fan before it ever sort of dawned on you that maybe you could make a career out of this, particularly given your condition?
Yeah, to be honest, it's very surreal. Like when we go to events, you're meeting Shane Lowry, Rory, like say Ricky Fowler, and they're coming up to you and they're talking, they're like, well, Brendan, how's things? Like, I was watching these guys as a kid on TV, thinking just being at the K Club for the Irish Open, being a fan, watching, is incredible. So for sharing the fairways, for sharing the same facilities, having dinner, having conversation with these guys, it's very, very surreal.
Yeah.
But the thing is as well, when you're in that company, you have to act normal, you have to feel normal because it's going to be a regular occurrence. If you start fanboying it, it doesn't look good. You're like, oh, can I get pictures? Can I get this? Just talk about general stuff. And that's what we do. Like, we talk about where we went for dinner last night. How's the family? What are you working on at the minute? It's not like, oh, come here. Can we get a picture? It's great to see you. It's very sort of friendship-like. And I think that's where a lot of sort of players kind of, when they're in that environment, they fan it a wee bit too much. Where if they just embrace it and feel like the opportunity is going to arise again, I think that's the right way to approach that sort of stuff.
It's one of the difficulties for good amateurs making the transition, isn't it, from the top of the amateur game to the professional game, is that you do enter an arena that you've been watching from afar for so long and you've worshipped these players. Very hard to just be normal. I imagine you probably didn't pull it off the first time necessarily either. You'd have been nervous and like talking to a beautiful woman. You get a bit of this going and you don't know what you're talking about. What did I say? They've left. I don't know what I said. It would have been some of that, I'd imagine, the first couple of times.
100%, yeah. And like, as you said about the amateurs, some of these guys are the best players in the world. And when they go to this environment, they're struggling.
Mm.
So that's what I mean, the mentality side. If you give them two or three events in the limelight, they're going to be far better.
Yeah.
There's an Irish guy called Matt McLean. He played the Masters. It was his first Masters. And obviously, it's a ridiculously hard stage to perform on. He didn't have his best week. But then he got into the Open as well last year, and he performed at the Open. So that 1 week of experience kind of passed on to doing well at the next event.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, there comes a point, I think, Brendan, obviously physical ability is hugely important, but when you get to a certain tier, Rory and Tiger and some of those guys are in a different class, but it's attitude becomes almost more important than aptitude in some ways, doesn't it, at a certain level of the game? Because you're not there if you can't play. So now all that's separating the guys isn't physical ability, it's how they handle their emotions and that mental discipline that you're talking about.
Yeah, 100%. And I think I seen a podcast about Tiger, and he said many of these guys could play like me, but none of these guys could think like me. So I thought that was an incredible statement, because he literally plans everything out. He knows what he's going to do before he goes out, commits to what he wants to do. And it just goes to show that process has stuck with him through his whole career, which paid off. Now, when you mention the physicality side, when you talk about disability golf, it's a whole different thing.
Of course.
I feel it's the opposite in disability golf. I feel we all have the same mentality of not giving a about our disabilities. But the physicality side can really enhance how good you are as a golfer, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So some with one arm and some with one leg of two completely different disabilities, but the physicality is very different. So that's the incredible thing about what we do. The best of the best in the world have the very same mentality and the very same physicality to play golf as well, because they're all off scratch. They're all off +2, +3, +4. We're off the same handicaps by the end of the day. And yeah, it's competitive.
It's unique golf in that way, isn't it? We'll talk about it not being in the Paralympics golf, and I think that's sad. And I know that some of the issues around it, we've spoken to Christian Hamilton about it, and I'll get your thoughts about that as well. But golf's kind of unique in that way, isn't it? Where someone missing an arm and someone missing a leg, but that's what the handicap system allows for. And then when you get to a certain level where the handicaps no longer really matter once you're plus two, plus one, plus three, it's really just about playing golf and getting the ball in the hole, no matter what it is that you're handicapped by, for want of a better term.
Yeah, and like, I think the look at us, like, we have disabilities and everything's different, but we play the same game at the end of the day, and that's what we're trying to show these organisations, that whether you have one leg or you have one arm and you play off scratch, you have the same ability to shoot the same score.
Yeah.
And people don't get that, but they're starting to get it now. As we play DP World Tour events, there's Kip with cerebral palsy shooting level, there's me with short stature, Juan Postigo one leg, all shooting the same scores. Mm. And that's what we're trying to showcase, that the best in the world really feel normal. They don't feel different, and they can compete at that high level against each other.
Yeah, what a golf swing, Juan Postigo. I know at the World Cup here in Melbourne a few years ago, he was on the range and there were tour players just stopping and watching, which they don't do often, as you well know, but he's extraordinary.
That's Juan is probably my best mate on the G4D Tour. So we'd, every tournament we go to, we usually rent a house. And, well, in Spain, we'll have all the Spanish cuisine. If we're in Ireland, we'll do the fish and chips, and it's just nice to, we love getting that break from the scene. So yeah, it's great to be at the golf course, but we love to come home and watch the movies and have a chat about just normal life. Yep. And my dad would usually come at me and his dad would go, and it's just nice to get separate from everyone else.
You, little taste of what Rory and Tiger and those top players go through, isn't it? But golf becomes the job and you're constantly being pulled in multiple ways. People don't really understand what a pressure that is. The scrutiny that you're under at the top of the game.
Yeah, there's a lot of media obligations. Now, I'm not saying we're on the same level as Tiger or Rory yet, but what we do, we probably are. We're changing the game in a different way, and there is priorities that come with it. There's a lot of media stuff. You really have to watch what you do. Then you can't just go out in the piss on a Tuesday night and be a tabloid on Wednesday morning. It's a little bit different now, but. As we said, we all love it. It's not really work because we have such a passion for it.
Mm. Yeah.
And to be honest, our golf does the talking. When we go out onto the golf course and you see when you see Juan or myself at a golf ball, people are in awe.
Mm.
And I think the event we play at the Australian Open every year is the most inclusive event of the year because we're right in the middle of the tournament. Crowds are following. There was more crowds following Juan Postigo last year than Adam Scott. And That's mental.
Yeah, it is. It is. And you couldn't find two. In fact, they should have put the two of them together. There's two great golf swings you could watch all day, isn't there? Just before we move on from that, I'll go on a side note. I wanted to ask you about this. Max Togesala, I'd never heard of Max prior to last week. In the US Adaptive Open, Max plays in a paragolf on one of the chairs that helps you stand up. He had an accident, I think, severed spinal cord. Shot 2 under around Pinehurst in the US Adaptive Open. Now, you play with these guys all the time. Most of us in golf don't come across this ever unless you're in my job and you've done a few stories and this sort of thing. How impressive is that? I would defy Rory to shoot 2 under. I don't care what tees you put him off from a paragolfer. That's an extraordinary achievement.
It's crazy. And you know what? No one would believe that statement unless they've seen it.
Mm.
I'm sure people are out there saying, no fucking way that happened.
He's off the forward tees, or must have been pitch and putter. I don't care what any. I don't. Wouldn't matter. You could start at 100 yards from every green. I don't know many people are going to shoot 2 under from.
He played all. I think it was playing 6,000 yards.
Oh, Jesus,
that's incredible.
Yeah, it's beyond incredible, isn't it? Beyond incredible.
We have our you have the growth side where the best players in the world play. The para golfers are fantastic players, but the scoring isn't as good as the guys are on the G4D. Mm. So to see this is another level. I'd have him at every event, 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. Which brings me to something. I want to come back to some of that and where we stand with All Abilities Golf, and I want to get some thoughts from you about Christian Hamilton and the role Australia's played, I think, in really promoting All Abilities Golf in a huge way. But zooming out and looking at more than just golf, we talk a lot on various podcasts that I'm a part of about golf's image and how we do a poor story in many ways of telling golf stories. And you see this in Australia, and I see it in Scotland. I'm not sure, probably in Ireland as well. A lot of public golf courses under pressure. You know, council saying we should close them. It's a lot of space to take up for just the use of the few. What you guys are doing is a much more realistic representation of what golf is like. So how important is G4D to the game more broadly and its survival? If we really do start to lose public golf, you can almost write golf off as a game except for a very small number of people. So talk a bit about the importance of that more broadly and how we can make more of what you guys are doing and what Max did at the US Adaptive. And that's a story that would resonate with anybody if they've got interest in golf or not.
Yeah, 100%. And it's funny, golf in general, disability golf, it was never, I don't like using the word, but it was never accepted to think, right, they have a disability. To be honest, they shouldn't have a right to be on the same course or they'll hold the game up. That's the perception of disability golf. So what the tour are doing for us, what Australia did for us, like, to be honest, Australia is the key in all this, where it all started. The main example is to get more people into the game, to make golf clubs more accepting of disability golfers. So this is just an example. In Ireland, I was the only one that played 4 years ago. And golf clubs didn't really accept what we were doing. To be honest, I had a bad experience in the golf club because I turned pro and they didn't know how to deal with me, which I was still just a normal pro, but I had the disability side of it. To date, we have 52 disability golfers on a program in Ireland. And that's only in 4 years.
4 years, yeah.
And we went out and won the European Championships last year with four of the best players in the world. And that's just in Ireland. That's one country. So I can't imagine what's going on. And that's the smallest country nearly in the world. So if we can get that case with all the veterans in America, if we can get it in England, if we can get it in Spain, because every country has a really good representative. Juan is Spain. England have Kip Poppett. America have Chris Biggins. If they can do their job on their side to get more players into the game, every club in the country or wherever they're from will become more accepting because the game's becoming normal again. That's what I think.
I agree with you. And you're talking about a country with a strong golf culture like Ireland. We're the same here in Australia. And I think you're right, this lack of acceptance. Golf's been very closed in some ways, hasn't it, even though it can be very open. For somebody who's had some kind of major traumatic incident, like Max, who plays in a para golfer, there's a lot of can't in their life all of a sudden, but golf is a can, isn't it, for those people? And I don't know whether we make enough of that.
Yeah, and to be honest, like, someone normal doesn't understand the determination or the mental side of someone with a disability, especially playing at the highest level. These guys feel as normal as you do. And that's, honestly, though, that's the message we're trying to get out. Just because there's an asterisk of disability before your status or before your disability professional golfer, it doesn't mean you're not feeling the same emotions as Rory feels over a 6-footer. It's just a different game. Don't take that bit out. It's not a different game. We're just playing it to a high level, being different.
What you've alluded to there is an awkwardness, and I think this is true beyond just golf as well. There's an awkwardness about the language when we talk about people with disability and golfers with disability. There's an awkwardness about not wanting to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing or put people in a position where they might be embarrassed. Is the problem with us on the normal side, quote-unquote, in many ways?
I'm not saying that there's a problem because we've been given this great opportunity. I'll put it this way. I'm very lucky to make a career out of golf. And if I didn't have disability in front of my name, I'd just be thrown in with hundreds of thousands of other professionals that don't make it. Because I'm different, because I feel I can promote the game well, I feel it was a fantastic road to go down. That's what makes me unique. I am different. I'm playing the game at a very high level. But I also feel it's very important that I stay in my disability field. If I played challenge tour every week and missing cuts, you're irrelevant. But if you're playing G4D events and winning and getting more people into the game, you suddenly have a purpose in the world. And I think for someone with a disability and is looking to promote the game, I think they need to know the right road to go down and not, yes, the professional side is fantastic, dabble in, dabble out, but you're the disability golfer making a difference outside of the game as well. And I think that's important to realize.
It's a responsibility, Brendan, that you don't have to accept if you don't want to. You clearly have. Do you see it that way?
It was like, I wouldn't see it as a responsibility. It was sort of a role I fell into after sort of winning Dubai. I was the first person to do a lot of stuff in the sport. And when that stuff comes, you sort of have an obligation to promote it. But as I said, it feels easy for me because I have such a passion for the game. I've such a passion to get more people into the game and to speak about it. So it doesn't feel like an obligation. It feels that you're doing something really good to sort of edge golf in history and kind of push it forward.
Yeah. What does professional golf look like for you? You turned pro, I think, in 2019. What did the road look like ahead there? What was the plan for that? And what does it look like? Clearly, you're not on one of the major tours. How does professional golf look for Brendan Lawler?
Yeah, so basically, I turned professional in 2019. Modest Golf approached me. This is a company run by Niall Horan from One Direction. So that was a dream come true. You're a disability golfer trying to make waves. And when one of the biggest stars in singing comes that has opened a golf company looking to sign you, it's pretty incredible. But it's hard to put your life in the hands of a singer that is so fresh and just starting off. But the guys have offered me some really good deals that sort of you couldn't refuse that weren't there before. So my dad approached me and he said, "This is fantastic, Brandon, but you need to have an offer on the table before you take the deal." I said, "Yeah, okay." And I was so eager to get it done. But dad he had a business mind. He was like, "No, you just need to be patient on this one. It will work out. Just be patient." So as an amateur in Ireland, you couldn't accept endorsements. So I was getting a lot of offers as an amateur and I couldn't accept them because I wasn't professional. So the only terms of the contract was you need to turn professional to get these endorsements. So Modest were like, "Yeah, that's perfect." So they came with me the following week with Adidas and TaylorMade, two of the biggest companies in golf. And that was enough for me to do it. So it was fantastic. And the disability golf was big at the time, but we didn't have the G4D tour. We only had four events on tour. So we didn't have much. So we sat down and had a chat with Keith Pelly and just find out ways to keep relevant in the game. And the G4D tour came up. Like, we're getting TV coverage, we're creating more awareness for the game, getting more people into the game. And it's just going to get bigger. Hopefully we're going to introduce a bit of prize money pretty soon. And I think it'll really kick off when that happens.
There's no question, because of course, at the end of the day, for all the nice feelings and everything that might create, it's not a charity, is it? You've got to earn your money as an ambassador for TaylorMade and Adidas. You've got to get exposure. You've got to be out there. Don't give Rory however many millions they give him a year to not do anything. He can't sit at home. He's got to go out and be Rory, and you've got to do the same. That's an important lesson, I would imagine, for you. It would have been an important lesson. It has been an important lesson in the realities of what that endorsement side of the game looks like.
Yeah, 100%. And I told you I'd be truthful here. In 22 wasn't a great year for me on the course, and I felt very demotivated. It was like, yes, the sponsorships are fantastic, but I'm doing this week in, week out. There was no prize money. Mm-hmm. Flights and accommodation were fantastic, but it felt like you were just going out onto your local course and playing an event. I felt very sort of dehumanized. It was like we were moved to Monday and Tuesday from Saturday, Sunday, where you are getting a lot of exposure, to be moved to sort of Monday and Tuesday. It felt like a big kick, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I struggled last year trying to get motivated to do well because there was no crowds. I had a lack of motivation in myself. There was plenty to play for, don't get me wrong. But it was a mentality that I didn't care. And then I sat down and spoke to my dad, and dad was like, "You're getting paid by the biggest brands in the world, Brendan. You're an advocate for the game. You had some big wins early. You're still playing really well. Your bad weeks are second and third. Just try and get that small motivation again and you'll be winning everything." And he said, "The more you win, the more these sponsors are going to pay you." So he said, "Just find it." So my game was struggling as well. Started 2023, I had a bad week. Not a bad week in Abu Dhabi, I came second.
Then, yeah, it's a bad week, Brent, then, I came second. See, yeah.
My mentality, a bad week for me is second.
Right.
I have 3 seconds this year, and I have the G4D win, which was incredible. That was huge. That really put me onto another platform with being the first to do a major. So as I was saying there, I felt very demotivated, and me and Dad sat down, and as a sports person, you do go through these different emotions. Yes, it's great. You love doing what you do. But you can't help feeling, if you feel demotivated, you can't help feel it, you feel sad, you can't help these feelings. So we basically said, just find it. Like when you're winning in 2020, find that juice, find that flow where you are mad to win. So it was coming, the second finish in Abu Dhabi, it was coming. Then I had a good week at Pablo Olazabal's event in Spain. Then we went to the G40 Open. And it all just clicked. I didn't have my best week on the greens, but as Rory does, I felt there was like a perk in my step. I felt like I was re-energized again. And I went out and won that event, and it done so much for my confidence. It done so much for sort of edging your name into the game again, and also getting more people into the game. My Instagram flooded with people trying to get in, trying to find what disability golf is, trying to play the sport. And that's the role at the end of the day. And that's what I love doing.
What you sort of alluded to there is you kind of become a performing monkey in some ways if you're not careful, don't you? And there's an element of that about professional sport, or professional sport, golf included, where it's entertainment, isn't it? It's not why you start, yeah. But you come to a point where you're playing weeks that perhaps you don't feel like playing or you don't want to play. These are all issues that most of the – if you don't have – one of the things that Tiger and Rory and those guys, it's amazing – it can't be about the money. They had enough money to stop 10 years ago, yet they still play, and they play at the highest level. So there's got to be something else to it, doesn't it? Money's important to a certain point. Yeah. Then you've got to get past that. And that's a bit tricky, I think, for some people.
100%. And Dad was like, you're probably the highest paid disability golfer in the world. He said, you need to get past that.
You'd be one of the few, wouldn't you? How many disability golfers would be professional and have endorsements? 2 or 3?
Very few, to be honest. We might have 6, 7.
Yeah.
So it's not a whole pile of players. So that's what we're trying to change as well. Mm. We're trying to change that the likes of, say, well, TaylorMade's the best brand in the world for me. They're unbelievable. But we're trying to Kips with Titleist, Mike Brown's with Mizuno. So these brands are starting to sign players, which is incredible.
Yeah,
as you said there, it's not about the money when you get to a certain level. It's about how many titles you can win. How am I going to change the game? But as disability golfers, when you have to pay your own way to go to these events, it's slightly different. Winning's great, but if you're not collecting a paycheck at the end of the week, you're getting some great exposure, but that's not going to pay your bills at home. And that's what a lot of these guys are struggling with.
Yep. Exactly.
So many wins in the last few years, and they haven't got deals, and they wonder why. It's a game on the course and off the course. You need to be able to promote it. You need to be able to speak about it. You have to be marketable. Yeah. There's so much areas to it.
Yeah. If there's no prize money on the course, especially the pressure to then try and get very limited endorsements, as you said, there might be 5 or 6 guys who are sort of professional and getting that really makes it competitive. So let's talk about that. What is happening in that space? We spoke to, is it Curtis? I think Curtis Barkley from Canada at the Australian Open last year. He was talking about some of the expense involved in getting to and from events. And he loves going to play, but at some point, you've got to pay the piper, don't you? People aren't flying everyone around the world for free and whatnot. Something has to shift in that space. How do we make that happen? As you said, you've been moved from later in the week to early in the week. Good on the DP World Tour for putting on how many events you have on the G4D Tour in conjunction with the European Tour events. But it's only really a start, isn't it? There needs to be more than that if it's going to become a legitimate going concern. Again, not charity. This has to be a business that can stand on its own 2 feet, doesn't it? What do we need to make happen to get there?
Yeah, 100%. And I think the Friday and Saturday thing, the weekend is very important for us. What we do, people need to see. Mm. If people don't see it, it's no good seeing it on Instagram or Twitter. You don't get the full effect. People need to see it with their eyes. And that's when we were Friday and Saturday, we were getting great exposure. We were getting more camera time, which was also important. And that is a bounce on effect to how much your sponsors are going to pay you, whether to keep you on or not for next year. the Monday and Tuesday thing's tough because we get a 1 or 2 minute video at the end of the week and no one really sees what we're doing. So we're trying to get this back to the weekend golf. We were chatting, we sort of have a players committee of, and we're very tight with Keith Pelly and Ben Cairn as well. They're very open to what we have to say. They hear it, they try and make a difference where they can, which is extremely important. But we do realise as well that we can't rush into things. We can't suddenly have 50,000 prize funds for 8 players.
No.
What do you do with the rest of the players? So there is a few limitations of how far we can go and how quick it can we can do it. But I think, obviously, with the new PIP and the all the conjunction, I really hope the money funnels down to the players as well on the G4D Tour. As I said, flights and accommodation's great, but if you could walk away at maybe 5,000-6,000 if you win for the week, it would help you go to put money into your game. It'll help you travel to the next tournament. It's becoming big. Like, disability golf is a household name now. We've changed it in that way. People, everyone knows about it. So now we're going to have to try and make it professional and make it marketable where people want to go see it.
You're in that it's a good problem to have zone. It's not a good problem, but it's a good problem to have in as much as it clearly means you're growing. These in part are growing pains, aren't they? Having to solve some of these issues and work your way through and think of the solutions to these things. Nobody was talking about this 5 years ago. So
yeah, it wasn't exist. A thing. No, no one knew about it five years ago.
That's right. So and the growth's been pretty quick really, hasn't it, when you think about it? I know there's a long way to go, but you've come a long way already. It's important to look back sometimes, yeah?
100%. At the very start, our aim was to have the G4D Tour, is to have our own separate tour where disability players at an elite level could play on. Now that came, when that came, every player thought that would come with something, like some sort of prize funds. But the tour are very good to us. They've given us a platform that no one else could give us. They've given us, they pay flights and accommodation. Each week was costing the players a lot. And we sat down with the tour a few weeks ago and we said, this is costing X, Y, and Z. Caddies cost X, Y, and Z. So now they cover caddy costs as well.
Wow.
And we get a slight reimbursement towards our taxis, towards our food for the week. So we suddenly went from flights and accommodation to an extra maybe $2,000-$3,000 with your caddy expenses and your food. So that was a big leap. That's a jump. It's suddenly costing us money to now we're breaking even for our weeks. So what's next? Making money. So it's just another step. So it's not that we have that far to go. We just need to get the logistics and do it the right way.
Has there been any pushback from the regular tour players in any way? Because they, of course, don't get that, although those things are starting to come in now. We've seen a huge shift in the game with LIV Golf League. It's gone from a eat what you kill to now there is payments up front to players on certain tours in certain places, which is kind of what you're doing. Has there been any pushback from regular tour players about that? Because for most of them, they bear those costs week in and week out. If they don't make the cut, that cost is on them.
Yeah, and we 100% get that. Like the players say on Challenge Tour are struggling to get on to the main tour, and the guys that aren't making cuts on the DP World Tour, it's probably costing them $2,000-$3,000 for a week at least. And we get that. But when we talk about pushbacks, it's only good that we got from the tour players. They love to see us there. John Ram was asked in a press conference in Dubai last year, do you think G4D Tour players should be paid? And his reply was, are they not paid? They're regular guys. People are coming in to see them play. They're not monkeys. They're not performing monkeys. They're players, and they deserve to be paid. So to get that from the world number one at the time was huge, and I think that really pushed our argument to the guys at the DP World Tour to get what we have now. So we're only 2 years into G4D as well. It can't happen overnight. But we are knocking on the right doors, and there is enough players coming into the game to make this a full-time thing.
What would that look like, do you think? How many realistically, what sort of field sizes do you have now? And what sort of field sizes could you realistically think, COVID, how many realistically G4D players could make a living playing the game as we see in professional golf that we're used to seeing on the major tours around the world? What sort of scope is there, do you think?
We're starting to get good scope now. If we're going to be in conjunction with DP World Tour, like we have to be careful with tee times. Like, how many players can we fit in on a Monday and Tuesday when players are looking to get practice rounds?
Yep.
if we go back to weekend golf, how many tee times are they going to allocate us? Mm-hmm. Are we going to be playing at 6 a.m? There's a lot of ways around it. But to have a competitive tour with decent prize money, I reckon we need 20 to 30 players at the same level to make it, to make it good for the eyes, for people to see. I reckon we need about 25 to 30, roughly.
And if you want to play the weekend, those 25 to 30 spots are going to come out of the regular field, aren't they? They can't add you on. Fields are pretty full in terms of time. So you can see the issues there, can't you? Yeah.
Like, do we stick with our Monday and Tuesday? What they said was, we were back to Monday and Tuesday to increase the field size, which didn't happen. So that was logistically wouldn't happen either, because players need practice times. The times we play at now are pretty silly, like 4 p.m. in Sweden we are playing. So we need to get, if we can keep the top 10 there at the minute and get it right for the top 10, we can then think about them problems. How we're going to, whether we have to go to a different week, whether we get our own tour to fully supplied where cameras are there filming what we do on a different week. It's logistically so much you have to talk about.
Yeah. And it's a step-by-step process. And I've started my own business here. And the things I didn't know that I didn't know, you wouldn't start if you knew them before you started. You've just got to
keep. Exactly. You don't think of that. All you think about is trying to do well. And all these obstacles come as you do it. And you just have to climb them.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. And look, as I think they're good problems to have. It means you're growing. These are growing pains. And all of these things, they'll eventually sort out in a way. They'll find a way, but it's a bit of painful as you go through. You mentioned something back there, and I do want to particularly mention Christian Hamilton. I can't sing his praises enough. And you mentioned Australia being at the forefront of all abilities and golf for disabilities. Tell us what you mean by that, and tell us about, from your perspective, Christian. And we've had him on this podcast here. He doesn't talk himself up, as you know. He could. He sure would. But the importance of him, because it feels to me like he almost started this global movement that's got us to where we are now.
Yeah, I can't talk highly enough of Christian. He's changed everyone on G4D's tour's life. He's changed, because I'm going to say it. He has the balls to go to the top guys and tell them what he wants.
Yep.
He doesn't sort of beat around the bush and saying, "Oh, we'll take that." He wants the top apple in the tree, and he gets it. And that's what I love about him. He doesn't go pick all the bottom apples. He goes for, right, we want these guys in the middle of the field. We want prize funds. We want full inclusivity of players' lounge. We want the lockers beside Adam Scott. And he gets it. He gets all that, because Australia are so inclusive of the whole thing. And if the DP World Tour can take Golf Australia's, how they think about the game and how inclusive they are with the disability golfers, we'd be a lot further with this game already. So we can, and DP World are at the Australia event. Last year was the first time it was in conjunction, I think.
It was, yeah.
So all the guys were there watching. And this year coming is going to be the same. So if we can show that all this works, that we can play in between times, we're not slow, we're not up the arse of the next group. If we can show the DP World Tour that all these problems they think are problems are not problems, we can be a lot further with this game.
Yeah. If we had 100 Christian Hamiltons, the thing about Christian is you can't say no to him. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. If he asks you to do something, he's got some magical power, and you just say yes and you do it, even if it's impossible. He doesn't do it with aggression, or he's not. He just manages to get stuff done. You're quite right. He's quite sort of remarkable. You mentioned Australia and the inclusiveness and all those sorts of things. Of course, the flip side is when you're doing something different, which is what you're talking about doing, trying to make change, you run into barriers and pushback, don't you? Because people are used to doing things a certain way. The Mixed Australian Opens, the men, the women, and the All Abilities all together, has been somewhat controversial down here. I think you played last year, did you not, down at?
Yeah, in Victoria.
Kingston Heath and Victoria, and I'll get your thoughts on those two golf courses just from a golf perspective shortly. But that's come with some pushback, and they've made some changes for this year. What do you say to people who don't think that's a good way to go, that they should be two separate events and that the All Abilities should be separate again? What do you say to them?
Well, looking from the outside in, it looks like the tournaments are run extremely well. It looks like there's no problems. I don't know, maybe there is. There could be problems behind the scenes that I don't know about. But also, it's not every week of the year where men, women, and disability players play together. It's like an occasion. But I think it should happen more often because the ladies are phenomenal players. The men don't mind playing, don't mind playing in the field. And then they don't mind disability players playing in the field either. So I think this event for whole inclusion, the field sizes are huge. That's probably the only disadvantage. The field sizes are ridiculously big. But I can't see any other disadvantage, and it's going extremely well.
And look, any problems that we can point to are all very much first world problems, aren't they? If play's a bit 100%. Slow, or there's not enough room on the driving range.
Problems do occur, whether you're working a 9-to-5 job. It's just people are comfortable with habit and the same thing every time. But I think people are scared of making change, whether change can be really good or really bad. I think people can be just scared of doing it.
Well, it's dangerous, isn't it? And particularly, I think this is partly what happened to the PGA Tour with LIV. If something's working, seemingly working so incredibly well, and the PGA Tour certainly seemed to be working incredibly well, everybody's making loads and loads of money, in some ways you'd be mad to change it, wouldn't you? I mean, in hindsight, they should have done a lot of things different, but you'd be kind of mad because the only risk there is that it goes bad, and then you look like an idiot if it's worse off than you change. So you can see why people are afraid of those kind of things sometimes.
100%. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. So you're right, Jay. On other podcasts about other topics, I've had people who are guests who've done PhDs on trying to change culture, and it doesn't matter what the industry or what the business. Changing culture is an incredibly difficult thing to do because people are attached to the way they've done things, and it's very hard to let go. If it works, it's very hard to prove that it's better and get people 100%, to take it on board and change. Why isn't golf in the Paralympics, Brendan?
I'm not 100%.
Even Christian Hamilton hasn't been able to get it into the Paralympics. What's going on there? They said no to him.
I know. I think they're the only people ever said no to Christian.
Yeah, maybe.
But I think with the case of the Paralympics, I had a chat with Christian in Australia. And he was convinced it was nearly over the line. They've done so much work. It has to go through a certain stage process. And we got to the last stage. And I think a certain amount of other sports got to the last stage and golf wasn't picked. Whether it's out of a hat, whether it's if your family plays a sport that's not in the Paralympics. It could be political, it could not be, but I think it's also a thing where the Paralympics feel they have to hand out 15, 20 categories of different medals, where all they have to hand out is gross staple for the net, like they would in any other normal event. So I think they're slightly overthinking it. If I had to say anything, I think they're just slightly overthinking the medal situation. But we have the players to play in it. It'd be a very competitive Paralympics, and it's a shame it's not in it, to be honest.
Yeah, I do agree, and golf really should be doing. And I think golf in this instance has actually done really hard work at the time. You can't always say that about golf and golf's governing bodies, but in this case I think you have, and the problem does seem to be on the other side. It's with the Paralympics, as you said. Golf doesn't seem complex enough for them. You can't have enough categories. How can you just have three when there's so many different types of disability? And they don't seem to be able to grasp that, and I think it would be refreshing to have golf in there for people who don't know.
What we're doing at the minute showcases that whatever disability you have, you're still on the level playing field. So if they can't see that and they can't pick that up from what we're doing, they're obviously not seeing what we're doing. So it's very, very difficult. If I always think of this, if you put five disability players in the room and have a chat with them, I reckon we'd be there. And we have Christian, we have Tony Bennett, we have these fantastic spokespeople, I should say. But I just feel if you could get five of the best in that room and just chew their ear for 5-10 minutes. I reckon we'd be there.
If all our golf talk has you itching for a round, then make sure you check out Golf Now. The Golf Now app and website gives you an easy way to book social golf online at hundreds of courses across Australia, including some of Golf Australia's top 100 tracks. No queues, no call waiting, just the tee times you want at your fingertips 24/7. Download the free app or visit golfnow.com.au today. Go play. You're comfortable in this environment, Brendan, and you commentate on Sky Sports as well on the golf, so clearly yep. not at all. Is that true of all of your G4D brethren, if I could call them that? Is everybody comfortable in the spotlight that comes with the position?
They're all pretty comfortable, yeah. This is actually a funny one. The people that were born with their disabilities are far more comfortable mm-hmm. than the people that have a traumatic experience and lose their leg, which is obviously, when I say that, it's pretty obvious. But you see the difference in people that had the traumatic experience later on in life, where the likes of myself, Kip and Juan, we've been born with this and we've had longer to accept it. And I think when you talk to these people and you see their attitude, you can actually get that from a few of the guys, that the difference in attitude towards the game or towards life can be so different.
For people who've had a traumatic experience, we kind of touched on this before, I would imagine golf can be a really powerful force for good, can't it? Because it's one of the few things you can do. We've got James Gribble. I don't know whether you know James. James is an Australian guy who, I think he fell backwards off a bar stool in South Africa and severed his spine. He's essentially a quadriplegic. And he uses a paragolfer to play. And I remember talking to him about it. You know, when that happened to him, there was just this endless list of things that you can't do anymore. And one of the very few can things was golf, because the paragolfer made it possible. That's hugely – forget about golf. That's hugely important for someone who's had a traumatic experience like that, isn't it?
My mum used to say when I was young, can't means won't.
Yeah.
So if she says lift the clothes off the floor, I can't do it. You mean you won't do it?
That's right.
It was just like me getting the butter off the top shelf. I can't do that. Well, if I get a chair, I can do it.
Yeah.
So I think you have to adapt to these situations on your own, whether you have a disability or not. And I felt people that are at the top level of golf and that have a disability have adapted to every situation that was put in front of them. And the long list of can'ts, there's more. The list of can'ts is a lot longer than the can'ts.
Yeah.
And I think that's important for these guys.
Yeah. And that to come back to the point I was trying to make earlier is that we don't tell that story enough about golf, do we? Non-golfers think golf is Rory and Tiger and exclusion and wealthy people. They don't, and that's not the case. We as golfers know that we play with mechanics and paddle beaters and butchers, and but non-golfers don't seem to get that. We've done a terrible story of explaining how inclusive golf really is and can be.
100%, and as you said, a lot of people don't get it, and you see that with like Instagram posts. Like it was very funny. I had a start in Japan a few weeks ago. And DP World put up a video. I hit like a wedge shot. I hit the pin, and it got, I think, 50,000 likes and over 1.5 million views. And I don't read comments, but I was going through some of the comments, and the negativity was horrific from your average golfer that can't probably even swing a club. So I was reading through these comments, and they don't annoy me. It was something that it never affected me, comments. But it's very hard for my family to read that, like, oh, midget golfer or small guy, he's a great short guy, all this shite. So I said, you know what? This doesn't annoy me, but I'm going to highlight it. So I done a post, and I picked out all the really negative comments, and I put them in front of a picture of me. And in the next slide, I put out a video speaking about the situation, basically speaking about how it doesn't affect me. But I thought this was a great time and a great platform to highlight negativity online and for more disability athletes getting exposure online to maybe not get that hit, to maybe give them like a coping mechanism to deal with the hit. Because I don't care. I think it's funny. The only thing annoyed me about it is I had a serious rip for every comment that I couldn't reply.
See, that's right. You, now that you've got the
that doors, really annoyed me. That's when we go back to going out on a Tuesday night and you can't do stuff. But I actually had my notes. I wrote down one or two of the replies. And this was a coping mechanism for me. And under it, I wrote my reply. And I was just pissing myself laughing of how funny my reply was to the negativity.
Give us one, because I wanted to bring up this incident, because you wrote a really good blog about it for the European Tour's player blog as well that week, I think, if I'm not mistaken, about those comments. So give us one of the comments and one of your replies that you couldn't publish. Come on, just a little taste for us here, just a special treat. You must have saved them somewhere.
Yeah, I had a really good one. It was there was one is he 12 or 33? And I wrote down 33 shots around better than you.
Very nice, and no doubt true, because in fact, anybody who's got any ability at golf would do nothing but respect the games of the disability golfers, would they? If you know anything about the game, it's unbelievable how good you guys are.
Yeah.
If you've got any
ability. People don't get it. And the average golfer seeing something different, they have that ignorance.
Yeah.
They have that sort of, oh, what's he doing on tour? Is this like, he doesn't deserve to be there. Yeah. But I feel that's uneducated people now. Because golf's a house, or disability golf's a household name, people are starting to see them a lot more. So I think it's kind of ignorant for people to judge someone that's trying to make a difference.
Yeah. Look, we say kids can be cruel, can't we? What social media has allowed is for adults to pretend they're still kids. Some of the cruelty of some of those comments was, well, it was off the, it's just beyond unacceptable. You can't imagine what goes through some people's minds. And none of them would ever put their real name to it. You know that that's.
No, it's all like keyboard warriors.
Yeah. Exactly. Anonymity has not been a positive. More broadly, though, Brendan, how much of an issue is that? And it's not just – it's anybody with any sort of a profile, not yourself being a disabled, you know, golfer with disability. Anybody with a profile just gets hammered on social media.
Yeah, 100%. I'm a smaller target, but I'm a bigger target online. That's what I love to say.
It's good to have a sense of humour about it. I'm sure that it probably doesn't bother you, but occasionally it must get under you. It actually must upset you. I can't imagine how your mum must feel if she reads some of that stuff.
Yeah, I can honestly hold my hands to my heart and say this stuff, it doesn't annoy me. You can throw all the shit at me because I grew up with this. When I went to school, people looked at me. I heard the comments. I'd be walking in a shopping centre and there's kids saying, look at that small guy. I've grew up with this my whole life. So to see this negativity, I feel happy and mentally strong that I can deal with this because a lot of people couldn't.
Hmm.
And I thought it was important to highlight for people that might be suffering mentally that if they can't take a negative comment, like one negative comment could hurt someone. There was hundreds on that.
Yeah.
So it was just a great chance to highlight for other people to take an example of it.
Yeah.
By the way, I can't swear on this podcast, can I?
Bit late now, isn't it? in typical
I apologize.
Irish, it's okay. In typical Irish fashion, you've already done it. So. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Don't be silly. I can bleep if I need to, but more to the point, we can put an E for explicit on it, and that's fine. I don't think we've ever had an E for explicit on this podcast before. Oh. So you're the first there as well. You're the first G for D open winner.
I'm still making history. You're the podcast.
First explicit golfer. Where's it going to go for me, Brendan? If I took you back 5 years and asked you to look forward, this is a difficult question to ask because it doesn't make much sense. But if you'd looked forward 5 years ago, I doubt you would have seen yourself here.
No, to be honest, we have a family business that does office furniture and CCTV cameras. And I worked there after college. And to be honest, I thought I'd be still working there. Working my 9-to-5 job and playing golf maybe on a Friday and Saturday or a Saturday and a Sunday when I was off. That's where I thought my life was going to be. I never thought I'd be doing public speaking, never thought I'd be playing DP World Tour events, being an advocate for disability golf. All this stuff wasn't even a thing. Didn't even know anyone could do it. So to be able to do it and to be able to make a career out of it, it's surreal. And I'm just loving it. Loving the experience.
What have you learnt about yourself? Because as you said, I think you're right. There's a real difference to someone who has this sort of trauma kind of thrust upon them, for want of a better term. Something traumatic happens and they go from being normal to sort of disability. You got used to all of that side of things because you were born with your disability.
Yeah.
You've been thrown into something. This is a huge change for you too. What have you learned about yourself becoming an advocate, an ambassador, public speaking?
I don't know if I've learned anything. Well, I felt I'd done well is I felt, well, you can call it fame. I felt I handled the fame well. I felt I stayed pretty grounded. I have an attitude where whenever I'm in a celebrity environment, I feel I can adapt well to it. But when I'm not in it, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm in it, I can really enjoy myself. But when you're not in it, it's not there. You just have to look forward to the next time you're going to be in it.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's where a lot of people get focused on. Right, I was in Rory McIlroy's environment yesterday. I want to be in it again. I want to be in it again. It happens naturally, and you just have to let it happen naturally.
Yeah, and it's actually that world's not that much different, is it? there's a lot more money and there's private planes and there's those kinds of things. But really, the people themselves, those around them can be pretty annoying and difficult to cop. But the people themselves generally, those who get there tend to be those who are, like what you're saying, pretty grounded.
They're the most normal people in the world. Yeah. Like, you need to remember, these guys just weren't born rich.
No.
They've worked their ass off. They've seen every side of the pie.
Yeah.
They've seen the poor days. They've seen the tough days. Yes, they're millionaires, but they still see the tough days.
Yeah.
Like Rory, his ambitions were to win tournaments. Like when he lost in Dubai last year, there was a picture of him ripping his top.
Yeah.
And people were like, oh, that's terrible. And no, I think that's fantastic.
I do too.
He's a multi-millionaire and he still has passion for winning tournaments.
He cares, that's right. I do too.
I think that's unreal. I don't like to see the negativity in anything.
No.
But I thought that was a positive. Him showing his anger because he didn't win a tournament.
Yeah.
It just shows that it's not about the money.
Yeah, that he cares. You've mentioned your dad a couple of times, and I reckon Rory's mum probably still says to him occasionally, oh, I didn't like how you did that. And I reckon he has to listen to her, because even when you're Rory McIlroy, your mum can tell you what needs to be done, and you have to listen. How important is that part of it? Rory, obviously, and yourself both, well, Northern Ireland and Ireland, I think Australia is somewhat similar. Do the people around you, is that what keeps you sort of on the ground? I think we're a different culture to America in that way.
100%. And to be honest, I'll say it on here. I don't have many friends. I have acquaintances. But I surround myself with family. Like, I get on very well with mom and dad. We'd see each other every day. My girlfriend, Rebecca, we live together. My brother lives next door. And my best mates are my two cousins. Like, we play golf every week together. Apart from that, I only have one or two friends outside that, and I don't really mind. I think it's important to keep it all tight. And what you were saying there, dad would keep you very grounded. Like if I was at an event, he carries me. So if I was at an event and I was out of line, he's the only person that can tell you what you're doing wrong and why you're doing it wrong. If my manager come up and said, you can't do that, it's different because it's coming from them.
Yep.
But if it's coming from your father, it's very, very clear that it matters.
It can only come from one place, from your dad, can't it? Because he cares. He's not interested in the 10% or anything else that it might have. It just comes from the fact that he cares. You know?
As I said to Dad, he gets 10% of zero.
That's exactly right. And next year you'll get a raise to 20%, but the base will stay the same at zero. Sounds like he's got a bit of a head for business. You said you've got a family business there. How important has that been? Because it happens to a lot of kids with potential and golfers with a bit of talent, potential for some exposure. The sharks start circling. How important has his advice been, just being in that world, which would have been really unfamiliar to you, I'd imagine?
It was – Dad's advice was huge. It was, to be honest, when things were starting, when I won my first few events, there was a lot of sort of deals coming. I'm not going to say small deals, but say local business is looking to give you a couple of hundred here, a couple of hundred there for your flights. The best advice Dad had given me, I said, don't take that money, Brandon. He said, I feel this is going to be a lot bigger. And if you do take that money, you're going to be tied to these people.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to want something off your back, whether it's pictures or signed stuff, whether it's a shout out every now and again. But if you don't take that stuff and you believe that you're going to reach that top level of, say, top brands here, you are better off not taking these deals. Because I believe that there's a lot more coming down the pipeline that you just want to be stuck to, say, one company or two companies. You don't want 15 different companies hopping on your back, and then 2 years later when you've made it, they're still hopping on your back. So I feel that was the best advice he ever gave me of not taking them deals. And he funded me for the first few years. It was all him. And he said, I'd rather do it. And you put CTI in the golf bag than someone coming in. And when something big comes, I don't mind if you drop me. I don't get to do it.
Kind of the sort of the perfect storm there. So I asked you if you could go back 5 years and look ahead, would you? No. What do you see 5 years ahead for Brendan Lawler? What's more important? You're in a difficult spot, aren't you, in some ways, because this advocacy and ambassadorship and trying to drive the G4D Tour forward, you've got those sort of obligations, as you say. But on the other side, you're trying to become the best golfer you can be. I don't know what your ambitions are with your playing. It can be tough balancing, can't it?
Yeah, well, I was world number one last year for 8 months, and I've lost it to Kip, which is Kip's a great player, but if you're world number one, you want to get back to that spot. I have four or five goals. My goal is to get back to number one. My goal is to get more people into the game. My goal is to have prize money in our rent. And my last goal is just keep doing what I'm doing. Enjoying life. I think this life can really, it can overtake you if you forget to enjoy it. Mm. And in 2020, I felt like I was winning everything and not enjoying it. So I made a plea to myself. If things are going good or if things are going bad, just enjoy the experience. And that's what I've done ever since. And I'm loving it.
Yeah.
I get to travel the world with my family. Golf's paying my bills. I get a lot of time at home to spend with my girlfriend and my family. It's a win-win situation. I love what I do.
Yeah. You mentioned 2020 there. I've often thought golf could be renamed Easier Said Than Done, because everything in this game is easier said than done, isn't it?
Just big time.
Work on your chipping, work on your putting, work on your drawing, and the results don't necessarily come. Everything's easier said than done with golf, I reckon.
Yeah, it's weird. Like 2020, everything just clicked. You know when you don't think about it and it all goes well, and then when you start thinking about it, it's a crock of shit.
Yeah, that's right. Falls completely off the rails.
That was a wee bit like the last 2 years. It was 2020, I didn't care. I was just pulling putts for fun. And then 21, I started thinking about it, trying to get better, and I kind of got worse.
Yeah. Kari Webb talked. We had Kari on this podcast maybe 2 years ago. And she talked about she didn't stop and enjoy all of her successes that happened. And she looks back now, doesn't regret it. She wishes she'd enjoyed it more at the time, but at the time she was just driven to get to the next one. As soon as you won a tournament, there was no time to enjoy it. Get to the next tournament, win that one, and then get to the next one and win that one, and get to the next one. And you can rob yourself of the joy you've earned if you're not careful, can't you?
Yeah, and that's what I did 2 years ago. I was winning everything. I won 3 or 4 events in the year, and they all took over me. And then I didn't win for about, I think it was 12 months. And let me tell you, I celebrated for the G40 Open. Oh, I think it affected my next performance in Sweden. Sweden was 2 weeks later. But
that's a good celebration.
It was the celebration.
2 weeks later. Quickly tell us about that. I mean, well, it's obviously, I'm assuming it's your biggest win because it's the most important and the start of something potentially really important, I think, for G4D going into the future. You won it by 2 shots, but there's a million ways to win by 2 shots, isn't there? There's a really comfortable 2-shot win. There's a really scratchy 2-shot win. There's a lucky 2-shot win. Tell us about the 2-shot win.
Yeah, well, I won't go into every round or every hole of the round. It was nip and tuck between me and Kip. I went out with 1-shot lead on the day. And after 3 holes, there was 2 shots behind. So I started bogey, bogey, bogey. He started par, par, birdie, I think it was. No, he started par, par, par. So he had a 2-shot lead after 9 holes. I was like, fuck me. Sorry. I was like, Jesus, this isn't good. So Dad said, you still have this. Kip wasn't playing his best. He was kind of winging it off the tee. His score was kind of being worked for, where mine was, it was steady. So he said, just keep hitting fairways. So I made a birdie on 12, went back to 1 behind, made a birdie on 13, back to all square. And I made a birdie on 7 on 16 to go 1 up.
Right.
We both have 17, and then 18 is a really tough par 4. It's kind of like a dog leg, right? There's a tree like in the center of the left side, on the right side of the fairway. So you have to draw off that tree, but you only have about 30 yards of fairway on the left, and then it's all rough. So it's a tough driving hole. So Kip was up first. So he hit his shot to, he pushed it right. So I was like, all I need to do here is hit the fair. I have a 1-shot lead. He pushed this right. It's dead there. So I ripped this driver. Best drive I hit all day to about, I think it was 134 yards from the pin. Kip had to take it unplayable.
Ouch.
So I was inside saying happy days, right? This is great. So he hit his next shot into the bunker. I hit my 9-iron to about 15 feet, which was a great shot just over the pin. Then he got up and down from the bunker and made a 5. So I'm saying, oh, here, don't 3-putt this, please. Don't 3-putt it. So I raced my putt by about 4 feet. So I wasn't looking at over it. I just stepped up. I knew where the putt was and hold it. Then all my family ran in. My managers were there. It was a surreal moment.
Fantastic. And one that you'll no doubt remember forever. And as I said, there's a bit of history there. Just on that, when you see him pushing, he's got to take an unplayable. And I know you're saying, you're cheering inside saying this is great for me. Does part of you feel a bit sorry for him? Golf's a funny game, isn't it, in that way? You compete against everybody else, but you kind of compete against yourself really only. It's a strange one, isn't it? You can be happy for your mate when he plays well.
I can tell you why. I didn't feel sorry for him. He bet me four fucking times last year. So I felt no sorry, I can tell you.
But I'm sure you bought him a beer afterwards.
Ah, we're great friends. Yeah. Me and Kip, it's like, we need that. We need that competitive. Yeah, of course. We need that battle. More people coming in. But as when the golf's done, we sit down and we chat. Hmm. We chat about normal stuff. And it's like a big family. And that's what I love about it. On the course, we're enemies, but when we get in, we're family.
The thing about top-class golf, I think, is that you want the other guys to play their best so that when you beat them, they know that you're better than them. Do you know what I mean?
100%. And Kip's been unstoppable the last 2 years. He's racked up some amount of wins. But the thing is, he's not unbeatable. Well, I feel he does well. He gets the best out of his game. He doesn't waste any shots. Where some of us are kind of wasting a few shots here and there and only losing by one or two shots. So he's definitely beatable. We just need to approach it a wee bit better.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, Brendan, it's been fabulous to chat to you. I've really enjoyed it. We'll look forward to watching the rest of your career unfold. You'll be in Australia at the end of the year, will you, for the Australian Open?
Yep, I wouldn't miss it. It's definitely the best event of the year.
You'll be in Sydney now. I know you'll be under a lot of pressure, but I'd love to get you to come into the studio here where I'm sitting and sit down with us the week of the Australian Open and have a chat.
100%.
Because it's up here, so that'd be it'd be fabulous.
Are you in Sydney?
Yeah, I'm in Sydney. So I'm on the other side of the Harbour Bridge to where you're going to be. Have you been to Sydney before? Yeah, you would have done because played the Australian and where'd you play? The Australian, the Lakes?
I played the Lakes in Sydney.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're on the other side of the bridge. So it'll be there as well. So the Lakes and the Australian, I think, are the two hosts. So one you'll be familiar with and the other one's not far away. So they're not quite Kingston Heath. They're not Kingston Heath in Victoria.
Okay.
What'd you think of them, by the way? It's
Victoria is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
I think it's better than Kingston.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think.
You could spend hours debating. I think Kingston Heath's the second best course in Australia behind Royal. The thing about those places, and Victoria probably suffers with it, I think they're magical. There's something. Did you get to Royal Melbourne at all while you were down here?
I played Royal Melbourne in 2019 in the President's Cup.
Oh, of course, right. Well, to me, that was the best presented golf course all year. Nothing came close to it for the rest of the year, 2019. That was amazing.
Yeah, I thought it was unbelievable. I thought the greens were, I know it's links golf, but they were bouncy firm.
Oh, yeah.
Like they were taking bigger bounces than usual.
Oh, yeah. And I imagine you got to stick around and watch Tiger because that was just an extraordinary performance from him that year, I thought, 2019. 24 world-class players in the field, and he was just clearly the best.
We were in the grandstands watching, and you remember when he walked in the putt early on Abraham Answer?
Yes. Yes.
We were there for that.
Yeah.
That was just cheeky. Like.
Yeah. He didn't feel sorry for Abe, I don't think.
No, not at all. No. Not at all.
Not at all. But that golf down there is special. What an opportunity to get to play Royal Melbourne in President's Cup condition. My goodness. You're one of about 40 people who's done it, who did it in 2019. Amazing.
That whole week was special. I hit balls in front of Tiger on the bridge, then over the water on, is it the harbour?
No, you would have been down in Melbourne, wouldn't you?
On the
river. What's it? The Yarra. It was Ash Barty was there too, wasn't she? Wasn't she hitting balls with Tiger as well?
Yeah, she was there as well.
Yeah.
It was, who else was there? Ernie Els, Cam Smith.
As they Adam were. Scott. Brendan Lawler.
Yeah, Justin Thomas. So it was a star-studded event.
That's fantastic.
No, like you can't buy these experiences, but it's just an incredible journey.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, it's been great to talk to you. We look forward to seeing you back here in Sydney. We urge all of our Australian listeners, and you're in Sydney, going to the Australian, go out and support the All Abilities guys. You guys still play in the main field here in Australia. I know you're back to Monday, Tuesday for G4D, but you main.
Yeah, no, we're in the main field in Australia.
Yeah, which is just extraordinary. And I think it's an eye-opener still to this day. They've been doing it for probably was 2018 the first time at the Lakes? That would have been the
2018.
Year.
2018. It was the first. Yeah, 5 years.
So this is 5 years now, so I think people are sort of more used to it, but if you haven't seen Brendan play and you haven't seen particularly Juan Postigo, what an extraordinarily beautiful golf swing he has for a guy with one leg. Just remarkable. You'll see some really good quality golf. We've got a couple of Australians who can play a bit too, so they're they're well worth catching up. Mate, it's been fantastic of you to take some time. We really enjoy it. We'll watch your career unfold from here, but thanks for chatting to us today.
Thanks very much for having me on, Rod.
What a player and a terrific young man. A big thanks to Brendan for taking the time to chat, and we wish him the best of luck in the continuing growth of the G4D Tour. That's it for episode 98, but I hope you've hit the follow button, because on our next, John Huggan catches up with one of the most recognisable voices in the game.
My passion for the Solheim Cup was undoubtedly because the Americans took the Curtis Cup that I played on in 87, 86.
Which you lost.
So much for granted.
Yeah.
Which we lost, and lost pretty solidly at a place that we should have won.
That's two-time major winner turned TV commentator Dottie Pepper next time on The Thing About Golf.